As the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is Stop Thinking, Start Being, or Stop Thinking, Start Becoming. This is not in any technical sense that we have used the word being, but simply becoming. Because we all know that though we speak, we talk, we plan about being brotherly, kind, good, honest, truthful, when it comes to practicing, we realize that we had not really taken into account what are the difficulties involved, how serious a thing it is to really start practicing these things which we glibly talk about. It's all in the abstraction. It is all in the air that we talk about being kind and loving and so on. We are a bit like that Mr. Henry. There is the little anecdote about a person called Mr. Henry, who it seems was very gentle and kind and used to always say, "Oh, I love children." And he believed sincerely that we adore children. And one day, when he has spread fresh concrete on his garden path, a child comes around, skipping all over that path, making everything mushy. And this Mr. Henry is looking at it, and finally he loses his temper. The neighbor who is watching this and who is well aware that Mr. Henry loves children says, "Why, Mr. Henry, I thought you loved children." And Mr. Henry said, "Yeah, I do love children, but I love them in the abstract, not in the concrete." There's a pun on the word concrete. But yes, so how easy it is to love people and things in the abstract. We have no idea when we actually, as they say, there is hands-on, when we try to live the life, we realize the difficulties involved. Again, we are very good at preaching, giving advice, especially as parents, as teachers, as superiors in the office, as well-meaning friends. We give a lot of advice to people what they should do, they should not do. And again, we forget that so many times it is unwanted, unasked advice. So many times things we tell them is not something which we practice ourselves. Again, then we remember what Gandhiji had done in one instance. You might be very well familiar with that particular instance in his life, where a mother brings his child, her child, to Gandhiji, and this child was eating too many sweets. So she tells him, "Why don't you just give him some advice so that he will stop eating sweets?" And Gandhiji just looks at them and says, "Okay, bring him to me in 2 weeks' time." And the mother and the child come back after 2 weeks. Gandhiji then gives the usual advice, saying that it will spoil your teeth and you might have worms in your stomach. It's not good to have too many sweets. It's the usual thing. And so mother says, "Well, why did you tell him this 2 weeks back?" And Gandhiji said, "See, 2 weeks back I was myself addicted to sweets. So how can I give this advice to him when I am myself not really following what I am telling him?" And this is not something which it should be taken lightly. I think just today's speaking tree carries a very small but very pointed article where one of the things mentioned is just this, that today we tell the young generation to do this, not do that, without ourselves following it. But they are too sharp. They do notice this. And one instance is given of a child who always noticed that his parents, they every day go to a temple, offer worship, pray, but as soon as they are coming out of the temple, invariably they fight with each other. So the child says, "I won't be going to the temple. I don't want to be fighting all my life." You see, so this going there before the God, praying, worshipping, you come out wiser, not that you fight at the end of it. So the association in the mind of the child, you are not practicing something, and if you tell the child to do something, you should offer puja, it is good for you, he is not going to listen. And one author has taken this even further. He says that today there are so many positions where we have to keep this in mind, that we practice what we preach if we are going to be role models for others. And these positions are that of a teacher, that of parents. He reminds us of the old Sanskrit injunction which says Matri Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava. He says that once upon obeyed by the, especially the young generation. Without question, even a king would always pay his reverence and respect and obey what was said by his acharya. But today, do we really have a teacher, a parent, who can become a role model like this? Where what it is suggesting is, look upon and revere your teacher, your mother, your father as someone who is as if were a god. Someone who is a messenger of God. Someone who can be a channel through which you can connect yourself with God. Do we really have such teachers? Do we really have such parents where they could be looked up to in this manner so that you put them almost in the position of a god? So how important it is, especially so when we are in such positions wherein we practice first before we preach and tell others, teach them the values of life, as it were. Moreover, we also find that when we teach them or preach them, when we have not practiced, it's not going to reach the heart. When you have practiced it, it almost has a magical effect on person. He wants to do what you say. We also find that when we have practiced, or if we have not practiced and if we tell, then we are at a loss to give further explanation. I mean, this is something, I think it is in our experience of all of us, that we say we must be calm, should not lose your temper, try to see good in other people, don't condemn them, don't do fault fighting. This is like we repeat. And then from the audience, if the question comes, but please, can you tell me how to be calm? That is my difficulty. Can you tell me how I see good in others and be calm? At the most, probably we will just repeat what we have read in the text. At the most, we will rattle off those steps which are there in the self-help books. Someone has done all that for us. There are anger management books, there are stress management books, and it's very easy for us to just know them by heart and tell that you should do this. But is that going to be as effective as when you have grappled with your anger, you have grappled with your stress, your anxiety? And that is something which is going to help you in helping others if you have really lived the life. But we find this to be very elementary and simple truths. Oh, it's so elementary, to be honest, to be truthful. We want to spend time on more abstruse views of life. We are maybe like that king who was going to be visited by a Buddhist monk. And the king is very expected to hear a long sermon from him. So he makes all preparations, makes the Buddhist monk be seated comfortably, and the monk begins. All he says is, be good, do good. And the king says, yeah, but then, that is all I have to say, the monk says. Be good, do good. And the king is hugely disappointed. But this is how simple the process of becoming is. It really entails or involves practicing of few simple truths. But we want to figure it all out. We want rational explanations. No doubt, at times it is required. But we want to think about it all around before we can start practicing. Again, you notice, especially the student has seen, whenever there is a question of practicing non-violence or ahimsa, see from the audience, there will be at least a few who will say, oh, but what happens if you are going and someone comes with open knife and charges at you? What happens if you see someone being raped, and are you going to just be bystanders and not do something about it? What happens if one community attacks another, one nation attacks another? Why think about such things which are not happening every day? These are once in a blue moon that you are going to be witness to, or things come to you. Daily life, what are we required to do? We can practice non-violence in thought. We can practice non-violence of feeling, non-violence of speech. These are umpteen opportunities in the day to be non-violent at the level of thought, at the level of feeling, at the level of speech. Do we really do that? No. We are more worried about what to do in such situations. And probably that is why we have Mr. Crosby telling us, we can apply what is possible and all that is possible to us. And in that application, greater understanding and facility arise. Each one has to find his way. Words cannot give it, yet there is a way for each. Most of the trouble lies in trying to see, trying to hear, trying to think it all out instead of applying what we do see. All ability comes very gradually, imperceptibly, felt, grasped, realized rather than perceived in the ordinary sense. Again, he seems to be saying, just start applying. There are lots of simple truths which you can apply. No doubt, there are tricky situations where you need to work it out. Deliberation is required. Moral choices are not so easy to make. Like one hypothetical example is given by one author, and such things we do come across. He says that suppose you are a servant of a person who is a robber, and he asks you to hold a ladder. While he will climb on the ladder, get into someone's house and do robbery. This is tricky. As a servant, it is your duty to do what task you are given. You are not going to take a single rupee from the robbery, all right. But on the other hand, you know why he wants you to hold the ladder. So what am I supposed to do? And he says this is not such a faraway situation. You may be put in such a situation probably when you are working in a police force, in a military force, in a government office. Then what are we going to do? Yes, then we will have to deliberate, as it were, and figure it all out as to what I should do in this situation. But again, not every time we are up against such a situation as this. There are so many times when things are so simple. Just be truthful, just be honest, just be loving, just be kind. It's as simple as that. And in that, we need not be wasting our time to kind of only theorize the thing. As Immanuel Kant says, these ethics, which are universal, they are like categorical imperatives. There are no ifs and buts about them. There is no if this happens or but this can go wrong. They have to be followed. And in following that, as Mr. Crosby says, each one has to find his way. You can't sit down and ask how to do this. Because as you do it, the technique will suggest itself to you. One person asked a bishop that, you always say love one another, but how do I learn to love? And the bishop said, you learn to dance by dancing, you learn to sing by singing, and you learn to love by loving. You begin as an apprentice, as a trainee, till you become master of the art. So, this process of becoming, the process of living, spiritual living, it's an art. There is of course a science to it, but a lot of it is an art. Where as you kind of take a plunge into it, you yourself will know how to go about it. And yet people want lots of theory before they can start the practice. Like for instance, sometimes students spend a lot of time in only metaphysics. And to that also we know Mr. Judge has said that the ABC of theosophy are more important than all these, what he calls as floating in the cloud, trying to find out the rationality of things, trying to talk about what is Parabrahma, Mula Prakriti and so on. Something similar happened to Buddha as well. We know in Buddha's Sangha, there was a person called Malunkya Putra. And Malunkya Putra always wondered, you know, Buddha very typically emphasized what is said here, stop thinking, start being. He was, as it were, a man of action. Start putting into practice simple ethics. So Malunkya Putra always wondered, how is it that Buddha either completely evades or speaks very little about metaphysics? So Buddha gauged his thoughts and said, do you want to know why I do it? Well, think about this. Suppose there is a man who is shot by a poisoned arrow. Now, someone else comes along, he tries to remove the arrow or call a doctor to remove the arrow. And if this man says, no, first tell me the caste of the person who shot this arrow. Tell me the kind of wood from which the bow was made. Tell me the species of the bird from whose feather the arrow is made. The kind of poison which is applied on the arrow. What would you think of this person? And the man said he must be foolish. What has all these things to do with removing the echo? He would die by the time he gets the answers. So Buddha said, that's exactly what I'm doing. I am telling you things which will only help you to remove the error. And that is dukkha satya. Sorrow is cause of sorrow, cure of sorrow, and following of the noble eightfold path or the transcendental virtues, the paramitas and so on. Start practicing and a lot of good will immediately begin to happen. Now, we find that this is the tendency also to be seen in religious people. In religions, what do we find? People pay only lip service to their religion. This is what even H.P.V. points out, that Christians, they pay only lip service. She gives the anecdote, or rather the happening in Christmas then and Christmas now, about how for Christmas people go into church very well dressed, richly attired, offer their mass and prayer, and then they come out. There is a beggar standing outside in tattered clothes, but none thinks of giving even a few coins to the beggar. A drunken soldier who is passing from nearby, he immediately throws a few coins and says, "Take this, you poor cuss." And of course, she says, a recording angel who was standing there immediately records this deed of nobility. But all those people, what were they doing in the church on Christmas Day, offering the mass and prayer? Festival of giving, that's what we call Christmas. And immediately after coming out of the church, they are not putting it into practice. So we are only paying lip service. And that is why she quotes Carlyle, who says, the end of man is an action and not a thought, though it were the noblest. And unless he sets and models his daily life upon this truth, the profession of a truth is not yet the enactment of it. And the more beautiful and grand it sounds, the more loudly virtue or duty is talked about instead of being acted upon, the more forcibly it will always remind one of the Dead Sea fruit. Cant is the most loathsome of all vices. So here we are told that it's not enough just to talk about being kind and honest and truthful. You can write a good essay, you can give a very good speech on it, but if you don't practice it, then it does not profit you. As Buddha said, he is like a cowherd counting the cows of others. He shares not in the blessing of the good life. You do not make any progress when you are only preaching and not really practicing it. It's like fruitless. The example is very telling of a Dead Sea fruit. You know, Dead Sea, I think it's either a sea or a lake in Palestine, which is so saline, its saltiness is so high that it cannot sustain life. The river Jordan is supposed to meet this Dead Sea, and the fishes which are thrown into Dead Sea immediately die. So there is no question of any vegetation growing there. So where is the question of having a fruit growing in the Dead Sea? That is why she calls it Dead Sea fruit. Sometimes people have only a kind of outward show of religion and spirituality, but actually they are not putting into practice. It's only an appearance. And that's why she calls cant. Cant is an insincere moral talk. You talk in such a manner that others feel you are highly spiritual, highly pious, highly religious, but in the process you delude yourself and you delude others. At least a person who recognizes his mistake can correct it. But a person who thinks that he is highly spiritual, he is never going to come on the right path. So she calls cant as the most loathsome of all vices. And very humorously, Saki has written in one of his articles or in one of his short stories about such people. And he says that, I don't mind being greeted, reverenced and honored. I don't even mind being moderately sainted, provided I'm not expected to be saintly as well. This is what we want. Don't expect me to be saintly, but I want to appear to be saintly and spiritual and pious. This is a grave error and a grave danger when you are able to fool others and fool yourself of being very, very spiritual when you are not really practicing that sort of morality and spirituality. Of course, one of the problems in practicing the virtues and morals could be that it's only a mechanical practice. It's worse than not practicing at all. You find that people may practice punctuality, extremely punctual people. It's a virtue, all right. But it's done so rigidly, it's done so mechanically, that it's more of a pleasure for them, that discipline, than bringing any good. In fact, it can be a nuisance to other people. And we don't have to rigidly follow these virtues, because then they stop bringing you any benefit. Like one of the senior students has humorously remarked in his article that when we say be punctual, well, you have to close the meeting at 7:15 or 7:30 sharp. That doesn't mean that you are speaking and half the sentence is done, you see it is 7:30 and you leave it hanging. What's the use of that punctuality? Or a doctor has to punctually attend the clinic, but that doesn't mean that if he sees an accident case on the way, he ignores that, but punctually at 10 o'clock he is in the clinic. So for some people, this sort of a punctuality or any virtue which is only rigidly and mechanically adhered to, it really does not bring any result. And sometimes it is our own brand of morality. Something which is only done as a custom and a tradition, we put it as morality and virtue. So Through the Gates of Gold says virtue, or what seems to each man to be virtue, his own special standard of morality and purity, is held by those who practice it to be a way to heaven. It is easy to become a gurma in pure living and high thinking, as in the pleasures of taste or sight or sound. It's only a mere pleasure. You love to be doing certain thing, but it is nothing more than that. So virtue, again, when it is practiced, it must be in such a way that it's going to bring about a change in character. For instance, lots of money given out of surplus, there is merit there, but it doesn't change a man's character. Whereas you have 100 rupees and you give it away, and that day you go without food, you go without some comfort, probably you are going to go by cab and you go walking. This charity is something which will get itself carved out in the character, in the heart. It's all right if you say, I'm very honest, I never take bribe. Good, as far as it goes. But what if you have 10 mouths to feed at home, and yet you don't take bribe? You're so tempted to take that extra money which comes, and you don't. That, again, is going to go and build the character. So, when you practice these virtues, not when everything is cushy and fine, but you practice the virtues when it pinches you, even when you are inconvenienced, even when you are in a tight corner, that is going to positively add a step in the process of becoming. But of course, when it comes to practicing morality, practicing virtues, the constant refrain is that, but then people take advantage of you. If you be kind to them, as the Gujarati proverb says, you offer them a finger and they will catch your wrist. Angri aake to pahuncho pade. So this is the experience we all have. But because of that, because people are not going to be grateful to you, people are not going to recognize how nice, generous, truthful, honest you have been, are we therefore not going to be practicing these virtues because of that, or they will take our advantage? Then who will set the example? After all, as Gandhiji says, you must be the change you want to see in others. Self-reform must precede world reform. And in this context, we do find today, and of course, it's not as if we look down upon it. Today, people are rushing and running and thronging the place where Anna Hazare is giving lecture. He is arousing in his own way public opinion to in opposition to corruption and all. Everybody is wearing a cap saying, "Me Anna Hazare ahe, I am Anna Hazare." And we really appreciated a columnist who wrote a small article saying, "Me Anna Nahi, I am not Anna." And what she had to say there was very, very pointed. That all right, I appreciate that people run and give you support towards fighting against corruption in the high places, forming a lokpal and all that. But these very people, when they go home, and tomorrow if they have to go to income tax office or government office and their work is stuck at some place, money is demanded, how many of these people will have the honesty and the courage to say, "I am not going to give you money, you had better do it. Or I am willing to suffer, but I will not give that money." Whether it is train ticket, whether it is cinema ticket, everywhere we are paying and willing to pay, chalta hai, little extra money and get the work done. Years ago, there was this black money which had to be given to the builders. The amount was very small and nobody cared. Thoda sa black money. And after that, now it runs into lakhs of rupees. And if you don't give black money, you will have to wait maybe for many, many years before you can have a house of your own. Do we have that moral courage to really say that I will suffer, but I will not support? Probably nobody will come to know about your this honesty and uprightness. But you remain true to your heart and be honest. So in that sense, you have to be the change you want to see in others. You have to set an example. And in the process, if people are not grateful to you, if people take advantage of you, well, something which happens at every step in life, and again feel what people are saying is right, you've got to be practical. Many times you tell yourself, you've got to be practical. What's the use? People are not going to recognize your kindness. In fact, they will take advantage. Then the student at least turns to these lines again and again, where Mr. Judge says, "In order to offset the terribly cold effect of perceiving the littleness of human affairs, one must inculcate in oneself a great compassion which will include oneself also. If this is not done, contempt comes on, and the result is dry, cold, hard, repellent and obstructive to all good work." You can turn very bitter and hard when you are good and either it is not recognized or it is repaid by ingratitude from others. But we have to set an example for others to emulate. And what we recall is something from novel by Victor Hugo, Les Misérables. Of course, it's very difficult for us to do what he has done. It's about the character Jean Valjean, who was put in a prison for around 19 years for only stealing a loaf of bread. And we are told that when he comes out of the prison, he is almost a hardened criminal. He is looking out for a shelter. Nobody will take him in. A kind bishop gives him food and shelter. And that night, Jean Valjean runs away, taking the silver plates which belong to this bishop. The police catches him, brings him back to the bishop. And the bishop understands the situation. He looks lovingly and kindly at Jean Valjean and says, "Oh, my friend, these are the plates I have gifted to him. But wait." And he goes inside and brings a silver candlestick stand and says, "In fact, this was also gifted to him, but he left it behind. So please take this also." Now the police had nothing more to do. They go, but Jean Valjean is struck. He gives back the silver plates and says, "Let me keep the silver candlestick stand, because this will remind me of your forgiveness." And he was a completely changed man. He was a completely transformed man. Now do we know that maybe 100 people will take you for granted, but one person may be transformed as a result of your goodness, your charity, your honesty. God alone knows who is watching you and who is taking you as his or her ideal to follow. So it is well worthwhile. And especially as teachers, those who have been teachers and professors will know this. 20 years hence, 25 years hence, students come and say, "Teacher, what you told, what you did, we are now following that." So one has to keep this good aspect of society and people in mind and be enthused to at least set an example of becoming by putting into practice. But as we put these things into practice, we find it's a uphill task. Stop thinking, start becoming. That is, stop thinking and start acting. The transition from merely thinking, talking, intellectualizing, theorizing, becoming armchair philosopher to actually putting into practice is a long journey, difficult journey. It will involve a lot of internal trouble, conflict, and step by step and gradually only the process of becoming can take place. Something which is put a little differently by a Christian author, Professor C.S. Lewis, in his little essay called Three Kinds of Men. And he describes how we all begin by being the first kind of men. First kind of people are those who live for themselves. They take care of their pleasures. Other people and the world, it exists to serve them. They are the raw material who should be used for his advantage. The second kind of men slowly are those who have begun to realize higher claims on them. They recognize that they owe something to God, they owe something to society. So if my interest or pleasure comes in conflict with the pleasure of another, I should be ready to give up my pleasure. They are the people, he says, they are like honest taxpayers. They give their bit of tax, hoping inwardly that something should remain for me to carry on. They are the people in whom there is a constant conflict. Their desires are running in one direction, and what they ought to do is in another direction. And they have to somehow reconcile. And so they are in a constant war, as it were, is going on internally. Then you come to a third stage, which is what he calls as, for them to live is Christ. Everyday actions are like commandments of Christ. Eating, sleeping, doing anything, it's like a commandment of Christ. Here, there is no longer a conflict. What he desires to do and what he ought to do is both in the same direction. So, this is something even what HPB says. She says that animal man has to become a human man, and a human man has to become a divine man. And what is a human man? Interestingly, she says, when acts of charity, justice, generosity will be done spontaneously by all, then you would have become human man. So imagine, spontaneous charity, justice, generosity, when that you do without feeling any conflict, it becomes your second nature, then you have become only human man. There is still a step to take, that is becoming a divine man. When all idea of self is effaced, there is no ego, there is no I, there are no personal rights for which you will ever raise your voice. There is no self-identifying attachment with wife, children, household, but the whole of the world has become Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam for you. That is divine man. And we, of course, are far away from that. But at least we recognize we have not even become human man. That spontaneously these acts of charity, justice, generosity don't get done by us. Now, here, let us not make a mistake when we say stop thinking and start becoming. Means, therefore, that we are looking down upon thoughts. Stop thinking is only in the sense stop intellectualizing, stop theorizing. Not that stop thinking, because let's dwell a little on it. Thoughts are the seeds of karma. Thoughts really form the very basis of spiritual life. See, in fact, let's read what Mr. Crosby says, the third quotation in the second part of the handout. Let us remember that the plane of action is thought itself, that is to say, ideas. Action is merely the sequence of the concretion of thought. So, there is every necessity for us to clear out the rubbish which we hold as ideas. Our minds, as a rule, are found to be made of a bundle of ideas of the race, of the people about us, of this ism or that ology. The mind is the power to receive and reject. So, thoughts are important. In fact, we have that lovely little four-liner for children. Sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. And sow a character, reap a destiny. So in fact your spiritual life in a way begins with thoughts. It is very important that we have right ideas and right thoughts before we can have right speech and right action. So in that sense we are not saying stop thinking. Thoughts, we are made up of our thoughts, we are founded on our thoughts, that's what Buddha is saying. And thoughts therefore have a great value and a great place in theosophy and the spiritual life. Of course, there is a difference between thinking of killing a person, thinking of raping a girl, and actually raping and killing. But on the other hand, Jesus also has said, he who looks upon a woman to lust after her has already committed adultery. So he considers even thinking about another person with lust, thinking about another with hatred, as equivalent to have committed the very act. And this is important. Let us not think that our thoughts are not punishable. In fact, with every thought which is created, it coalesces itself with elemental and becomes an entity. It becomes an actual entity. So, if you fix your mind in hatred on a person, you create a little devil. And if you fix your mind on another person in kindness, you create a little angel which is sent to that person, either to bless him or as it were to beat him with a tiny stick. But we are not aware of this happening on invisible level. And therefore when HPB is asked that are our thoughts punishable, and she says luckily for ordinary people their thoughts are stillborn, you know. They don't have the power and intensity, and if clairvoyantly you can see your thought, she says those thoughts they fall just in front of you. The entity which gets created, you will find falling in front of you. But if it is an intense thought, it can travel thousands of miles. That's what happens in telepathy, where of course there are different considerations. But so these thoughts we are continually receiving and sending. If you are thinking of being upright and honest, and if another person is struggling whether to take bribe or not to take bribe, your thought will go and hit him. And if he is little wavering, and if you have given in to your temptation, that elemental carrying that particular weakness will go and give him an impetus to maybe take bribe. He is just waiting to get that extra impetus. So we don't realize that therefore, not only through action you set an example, through your thoughts even you are able to affect others. So in that sense, thought becomes the basis. Thought, we are not saying stop thinking and not have thoughts. Be very vigilant about what kind of thoughts you have, because based on thoughts are going to be your actions. And that's why he writes, what we attract what we love, and we may derive a greater strength from the vitality of thoughts infused from without than from these those self-produced within us at a time when our nervous vitality is exhausted. It is a solemn thought, this, of our responsibility for the impulse of another. We live in one another, and our widely different deeds have often a common source. So, this brings out sufficiently the importance of thoughts. I think our time is run out and we don't want to carry on this any further. But to take care of our action, therefore, we have to take care of our thoughts. We will see the remaining things through questions. This is again a lot to do with becoming, as it were. And we would only say, start doing it and you will see how you reach that state. The question is based on something which is about to come in the chapter on bhikkhu, which says that the bhikkhu is happy within himself. How can anyone reach that stage, we don't know exactly where this is, happy within himself. Yeah, so even no matter what the conditions are, he is able to be happy within himself. No? This is what is the whole sadhana of life, we can say. Because we mentioned that there is also a transition from becoming from the human man to the divine man. And what is becoming a divine man? In a way, as you gradually progress, what has to be cultivated is detached concern, detached attachment. So when the degree to which you have become detached, to that degree you are learning to turn within, whether it is for guidance, whether it is for peace or for happiness. You are not dependent on other people for your happiness, on other things for your happiness. It's a very, very central thing, abhyasa and vairagya. Abhyasa is constant practice and vairagya is detachment. And this detachment is not something which comes tomorrow. Because, you see, desire made pure, that little note is there in packet number 7. And what is said there? That these attachments which are there, which are described as various kinds of desires, physical desires, desire for material wealth, desire for clothes, desire for any of the material things, they are the first which gets shared. Then comes desire for abstractions such as fame, name, power, glory, and even love of other people for you and your love for other people. Even if you don't have anyone who will allow you to, as it were, demonstrate your love for that person, you should be perfectly happy with it. This is something which gradually happens. And in the last paragraph, in that note, we are told that it's when you are pursuing the desires, you come across a stage where it all turns to dust and ashes in the mouth. When you are running after something, a person or a thing, but when you have obtained it, it all turns to dust and ashes in the mouth, because either it is not what you wanted it to be, or you just don't get it, or you get it but you are not too happy with what is there. So finally it all turns to dust and ashes in the mouth. And life itself is a great teacher in cultivating detachment. So we are not shown any steps as to how we should cultivate detachment. But as we have experiences in life, gradually we become detached. I think this is a particular instance which is quoted so often from this platform about same poet Akhabhagat, who was a goldsmith by his profession, and his sister tells him to make a gold necklace, and he makes that gold necklace for her. She makes that gold necklace to get tested from another goldsmith, and he comes to know, he gets a shock, and he feels such hollow relationships. He sees the hollowness of human relationships, and then he leaves behind that profession and he becomes a saint, a bhagat, as it were. So sometimes these jolts we get in life. Sometimes it is too much of satiation which leads you to leave that thing behind. So what it is that will bring about detachment, it's very difficult to say. We have also quoted about that a few of the jainas who suddenly took diksha. He was a merchant, diamond merchant. And one fine day he felt, what is all this wealth? What is all this show and pomp and what am I going to do with it? And he walked out, throwing these diamonds into potlis and throwing it in the crowd, he took diksha. What is it that really brought this sudden change within a person? So how that detachment comes, we don't know. But as even that little thing, desire made pure, says, life itself will teach you this. As you become dependent and you find that it's not good to be so dependent. Start with small thing, this peace pilgrim. She has written very well on this detachment. She says that we tend to get attached to our television set. We tend to get attached to so many utilities which are there in the house. And when the television comes off, we feel as if we have become totally alone. When that phase comes, you suddenly wake up. You realize I should not be so dependent on television, even so dependent on books, so dependent on this person. When a near and dear one dies, it's a very shocking thing. Especially you were dependent on that person, not for everyday things, but even for emotional support or anything, companionship, you are shattered. Read that book, A Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion. That is a book where, well, almost 50 years of togetherness of husband and wife, and how she spends one entire year trying to forget the memories of her husband and be on her own. Because everywhere they used to go together, do things together. So, I mean, we can just go on and on about it. But there is no simple method wherein you can be taught detachment by self. It's something which just happens as from step to step in life. You have experiences, you become detached. And when you become detached, you are not going to remain in the air. You turn within. You learn to get your happiness and peace from within. That's the whole thing. We are told, don't be looking outside for things. Turn within, whether it is happiness or peace. Bahirmukhi and antarmukhi. So, internally, when you turn inwards, that's how a bhikkhu is. He gets what is called sahaja ananda. One of the three things which is said about Godhead is sat chit ananda. And that ananda or bliss is sahaja ananda. It's the ananda which is not dependent on anything. It is sahaja. It is just there. No matter, irrespective of presence or absence of things or people, it's simply there. That bliss is what an advanced person experiences. And in the process, of course, again and again in the chapter on bhikkhu, we are told about meditation. So positively, you are supposed to undertake, set apart a little time in your life for meditation. Otherwise, we never turn inward. That's the only set time when we turn inward, when we are meditating, actually drawing in our senses, our mind, our faculties, and then concentrate on something inward. So if this practice is kept up, and a man of meditation is the one who is always happy. One short question. Yeah.
In order to offset, there will be four degrees of perceiving, between the
That's what we brought out during the lecture, that he is writing generally, but we do come across this. You are good to people and they are so ungrateful to you. You are being honest, but people don't appreciate. Sometimes in spite of being honest, you find that all the others in the office who are taking bribe, they will make a case for you and try to, as it were, frame you. And you are in a terrible situation in spite of your honesty. In little things of life, you find that people are not really as good as you are trying to be to others. And so, it is littleness of human affairs. In little things, you get jolts, as we were just describing, you get jolts from people. Ungratefulness is there, not appreciating is there, downright harassment is there. In little things, you only have to go to any office and you will find, sometimes in the family. Sometimes in the family, mother-in-law, daughter-in-law, two sisters, two brothers, husband and wife, the little things which happen upset you. That in spite of my being so good, how is it that the meanness of humanity, you can say, that meanness can upset us. And you may feel, what's the use of being good? And then he says, let's have a lot of compassion. Compassion, at least if nothing else, forgive and largely forget whatever happens. And in that compassion, include yourself. Feel that compassion even for your lower self, which is getting all agitated and irritated. Feel that compassion. And then you will be able to once again carry on in this mean world as we describe, which is not all good, all that mean, because there are good people also.